Good morning, everybody. Thank you for being here today to share the Dharma together. As usual, if you need to shift your posture during a Teisho, please feel free to do so. But do sit with your back straight and the head up. And keep in mind, Teishos are not about information or lectures in the usual way. Become one with the listening. Listen with an open heart and an open mind. Our usual practice at these insurrections is to comment on a koan. Koans are certainly a fertile ground for exploring the Dharma. However, this morning I'm going to depart from that custom and try to deal with the reason many of us come here to practice. In our introduction to Zen seminars, the most common reason participants give for coming is to seek peace. Where can we find real peace in a world that is beset with so much anger and violence? It can arise in anyone. I'm sometimes surprised and a little bit saddened when I hear people who are serious practitioners of the way express truly vitriolic antipathy towards a politician or some other public figure they disagree with or just don't like. I have to say I see this in myself as well. The search for peace often arises out of our anger. We find ourselves disturbed or even frightened by angry thoughts, images of retribution and vengeance. If, as the Buddha says, we are whole and complete just as we are, why are we so screwed up? Where does my own anger come from? Part of the answer might lie in what we mean by the terms like perfect and complete. If we think of perfect as opposed to imperfect or complete as opposed to incomplete, we're caught in a dichotomy, just like the ones of good and evil, tall, short, man, woman, ignorant, enlightened, and so on. I think we sometimes get a romantic view of the Buddha and his disciples as being utterly without any fault whatsoever, and that our job is to attain to some sort of primordial innocence that was somehow lost. In fact, one of the main jobs the Buddha was faced with was to mediate disputes and to try to maintain the harmony of the Sangha. He developed a whole protocol for dealing with conflict and wrongdoing, which turns out to be very similar to our own statement of ethics and grievance procedure. On his great awakening, the Buddha said, "Wonder of wonders, all beings are whole and complete, just as they are, endowed with wisdom and virtue." But that is not the end of the quote. We tend to forget the rest of it. But due to the ignorance built up over countless past lives, they are unable to bear witness to this fact. Now, what the Buddha was referring to is this whole matter of karma. For some reason, we don't talk much about karma at this center. And that can be problematic. Karma becomes the elephant in the living room that no one talks about. Karma is defined as the law of cause and effect as we experience it personally, especially as regards to morality. But far more than that, karma is the one great fact of our lives in time and space. Everything that we experience, including the rising and passing away of thoughts, feelings, and our very sense of self is the karma of this moment, the result of the ignorance of countless past rebirths over many eons. Karma is the great illusion that stands between us and our ability to truly bear witness. What is it to bear witness? It is to live in accord and act in accord with our true nature, the great reality itself. This sounds simple, but it's not easy. Because first we have to work to get beyond our karmic human nature and get in touch with that Buddha nature. In other words, bearing witness must come out of a genuine spiritual practice. Quite a few years ago now, some Zen Center members, along with folks from the Buddhist Peace Fellowship, spent an hour or so every Wednesday morning sitting Zazen on the lawn in front of the state capitol. We didn't shout or set anything on fire. We just sat. That's one way to bear witness. Taking part in a violent demonstration and wearing a ski mask is not bearing witness. Drowning out the voices of those with whom you don't agree is not bearing witness. Trying to force others to live by your beliefs is not bearing witness. All that is just the ego self thrashing about, the elephant completely unleashed. It may be appropriate to march, to gather, to say, "Here I stand," or to collect signatures, or to campaign, but to give vent to rage is not. We have within us the seeds of great enlightenment, great good. But as the Buddha said, due to the karma from the limitless past, we have within us the capacity for terrible savagery as well. This is pretty much self-evident if we consider current events, or really the events of any point in human history. That is why we have to practice. Contrary to what many Buddhist practitioners may believe, we are not born innocent or even particularly good. Just ask my mother. A very wise man once said that you don't have to teach a child how to behave badly. This is dealt with in a sutra. Mālūṇkyaputta is a disciple of the Buddha. And upon being asked, he lists the five lower fetters, which are identity view, that's the I, the me, doubt about the teachings, adherence or attachment to rules and observances, sensual desire and ill will. Now, Mālūṇkyaputta is of the opinion that these fetters exist only when they become evident in our behavior. But then the Buddha asks, would not the wanderers of other sects confute you with the simile of the infant? For a young, tender infant lying prone does not even have the notion of identity, so how could identity view arise in him? Yet the underlying tendency to identity view lies within him. A young, tender infant lying prone does not even have the notion of teachings, so how could he doubt about the teaching? How could doubt about the teachings arise? Yet the underlying tendency to doubt lies within him. And the same argument applies to rules, desire, and ill will. The tendencies lie within us at birth. The tadula is not rasa. Mālūṇkyaputta thought that we are fettered by the defilements only when they arise into consciousness and not at other times. The Buddha makes the point that even when these fetters do not consciously manifest, the potential is still there until they are eradicated through our practice and all that that entails. I think we can all recognize the tendencies in ourselves. We are made more aware of these tendencies in our Zazen and as we study the precepts. It is only through that awareness that we can deal with them. I used to say that the higher the motives you ascribe to yourself, the greater the atrocities you give yourself permission to commit. I think I may have gotten it backwards. It may well be that hatred and violent emotions arise first, and then we seek out ways of justifying them. The more extreme the emotions, the higher the moral ground that we seek. And what higher purpose could there be than saving the planet or reforming humanity? The Buddha explains further. An untaught, ordinary person who has no regard for noble ones and is unskilled and undisciplined in the Dharma abides with a mind obsessed and enslaved by ill will, and he does not understand the Dharma actually is the escape from the arisen ill will. And when that ill will has become habitual, it is uneradicated in him. It is a lower fetter. Same applies to the other fetters of doubt, lust, rules and ritual, and identity. The Buddha refutes completely the view of the noble savage put forth by the French philosopher Rousseau. The idea that primitive people were naturally noble, peaceful, and cooperative. In his book, Guns, Germs, and Steel, Professor Jared Diamond describes what happened when a New Guinea hunter-gatherer tribe called the Fayu gets together. He writes, "It turned out that the Fayu normally lived as single families scattered through the swamp and coming together once or twice each year to negotiate exchanges of brides. One colleague's visit coincided with such a gathering of a few dozen Fayu. To us, a few dozen people constitute a small, ordinary gathering. But to the Fayu, it was a rare, frightening event. Murderers suddenly found themselves face to face with their victims' relatives. One Fayu man spotted the man who had killed his father. The son raised his axe and rushed at the murderer, but was wrestled to the ground by friends. Then the murderer came at the prostrate man with an axe and was also wrestled down. Both men were held screaming in rage until they seemed sufficiently exhausted to be released. Other men periodically shouted insults at each other, shook with anger and frustration, and pounded the ground with their axes. That tension continued for the several days of the gathering." And Professor Diamond continues, "Anthropologists formerly idealized band and tribal societies as gentle and nonviolent, because visiting anthropologists observed no murder in a band of 25 people in the course of a 3-year study. Much more extensive long-term information about band and tribal societies reveals that murder is a leading cause of death. For example, when a woman anthropologist was interviewing a Yao women about their life histories, woman after woman, when asked to name her husband, named several sequential husbands who had died violent deaths. A typical answer went like this: my first husband was killed by LOP raiders. My second husband was killed by a man who wanted me and became my third husband. That husband was killed by the brother of my second husband, seeking to avenge his murder. Such biographies prove common for so-called gentle tribespeople and contributed to the acceptance of centralized authority as tribal societies grew larger." peaceableness, peaceableness may be our birthright, but it is not our karmic inheritance. In a society of widely scattered family groups, peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution does not happen because it has never been learned. It never had to be learned. If you're a small group of hunter-gatherers, it is perfectly possible and much easier to walk away from a conflict and go live several miles away. As Diamond points out, it is only when large numbers of people are forced to live together with no easy escape does it become necessary to learn peace. It is then that nonviolent conflict resolution becomes a necessity for survival. It is only in the seething crucible of intense social interaction do we really see ourselves, our reactions, and the reactions of others. Peace is not just the absence of war. The episodes of peace that we think of in human history were nothing of the sort. They were a series of armistices, brief respites, while the various warring parties got their military and economic acts together so they could resume the war, the ever ongoing war. There has never in human history been a period of any significant length of time in which there was truly no war or preparation for war. Not all wars are huge. We think of the hiatus between the two world wars as peace. But study what went on in Russia during that time. Study what happened in Ethiopia, the behavior of the Japanese in China. Conflict, violent and deadly conflict, seems to be as endemic to the human race as the common cold. I read a story some years ago, not sure where, concerned a young man who was tramping through the back country of Northern Ireland, far from the nearest village. He came upon a small hut, and sitting on a bench in front of the hut was an old woman, smoking a pipe. She saw that the young man was tired and offered him some tea. So they sat and talked a while. And this was during the 1970s, when the IRA and the British were fighting it out. Suddenly, the old woman broke into a detailed and horrific account of a massacre of innocent people by the British. The young man was horrified because there had been no news of it in the media. He asked how could it happen and who was in charge. The old woman replied venomously, "It was Cromwell, the dirty dog." Yes, if we hang on to our anger, even after generations, we can keep it as fresh as if the cause of it were only yesterday. Peace is the Buddha's practice, but it is not a peace that can be imposed on the world. The peace within, that which passeth all understanding, is a peace that cannot be attained. It can only be discovered. The peace we seek in our practice is not a return to some primal state in which all people are naturally peaceful, nonviolent, or non-aggressive. The myth of the noble savage is just that, a myth. We're not returning to some Edenic state. If we are returning to anything, it is something that was lost a very, very long time ago, uncountable lifetimes. This great return is possible. It's what we work toward every day. But it's not easy. It involves very hard work. It requires training and practice. Hard and persistent training, long and dedicated practice. It requires us to go beyond our old selves and learn to see, think, and react in ways we have not done before. So understand, please, going beyond is really going beyond. Don't look backward. Greed, hatred, and ignorance rise endlessly. Endlessly. I vow to abandon them. How do we do this? See karma clearly for what it is. See your life and time and space for what it is. An illusion built up over countless past lives. Not to reject it or fight against it, but to acknowledge it. You have to take full ownership of your practice, your karma, and your life. Those are all words for the same thing. There are two phrases that I found of great value to calm the angry mind when stuff comes up, when I feel outraged or frustrated about. One is simply, "This is my karma." I find that helps me accept whatever it is and allows me to respond in a much more appropriate manner, in accord. The second is, whatever suffering I experience, it ends with me. I will not pass it on. Okay, I can't guarantee results for others. You might have to come up with your own words. But it's an attempt that's well worthwhile. There have been men and women who have faced the violence and conflict in themselves and overcome it to such a degree that they were able to change not just themselves, but the world around them. They caused profound and long-lasting change, sometimes in most unexpected ways. The Buddha stood aside and watched the invading Magadha army destroy the Shakya clan. He did nothing and found peace only within himself. The Tibetan mystic Milarepa began as a murderer and became a sage and a teacher. Angulimala began as a serial killer and became a midwife and a saint. Each faced their suffering square on, found real peace, and bore witness to that great peace. Don't fight karma. Don't try to run away from it. How can you run from your own true nature? Find your way to embrace your karma, your life, and your practice with peace, joy, and even with love. Together with all beings, we realize the way.